ground shortly here, and H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
And it is Saturday once again, the 4th of October in the glorious future year of 2025. And I am feeling a little poorly right now. I apologize for that. I hope what I'm coming down with isn't contagious. I'm back in Munich, and a friend is visiting from Helsinki. And we went today to Deutsches Museum. Which is, of course, as you've heard me mention it before, an important technical museum here in Munich. It is probably not the biggest and most important technical museum in Germany because of the new one in Berlin that was formed by merging the collections of a number of different museums. But it is a wonderful technical museum. So when I go, as I went this time, I bought the year's pass because the year's pass is the price of three regular admissions, and it's valid in all three of the locations in the Munich area. There's an affiliated museum in Bonn that it's not good for some reason I don't understand. Anyway, but they have the main building on an island in the river Isar, and that is currently, only about a third of it is open, maybe less, because they are refurbishing it. It's been open for 100 years. Construction actually started before the beginning of the First World War, but of course that made everything much more difficult. Deutsches Museum, if I have mentioned it before, was the brainchild of industrialist Oskar von Miller, who was also responsible for the hydroelectric power plant in Kochel, south of here, in the foothills of the Alps. And he was great pals with all manner of other industrialists of the period, and so they would give him stuff to put on display, their makers' models of various things. And so, you know, you go in there and there's, for example, Rudolf Diesel's first working engine. And the computer area is currently closed, but before it closed, I went and saw the Zusa computer and the they've got Remington Rand UNIVAC with the god-awful mercury delay lines, which I hope they've drained, and, a Cray with the nice plush seating area. The other thing, by the way, speaking of Konrad Zuse, they have currently on display in the bridges and waterworks area his self-assembling tower, which is this thing that only a German could love. It's a marvel of precision engineering, which does the hardest possible way a task which could be done in dozens of other ways. But it is a very lovely museum, and if you ever get a chance to go there, I strongly recommend it. Regular admission is 15 euros, and I went up to the cafe partway through my visit, and I had lunch there, and I spent about 30 euros on the lunch. The cafe is nominally outside the museum itself, and you can actually get to the cafe without paying admission for the museum. So if you want to go from the museum to the cafe and back again, it was being guarded by this Gorgon of a man who... He insisted on stamping my hand so I could go from the museum into the restaurant, but when I came out, he refused to pay any attention to the hand stamp and insisted I show him my ticket. Why did he insist on stamping my hand? I can't imagine. So, I do want to introduce to you, and this is courtesy of SDFer Stug, for whom I only have good words. He took charge of something which was rather important to me, because I had gotten a video cassette. Now, a while back, I bought this video cassette called A Day Out, which was related to one of the strangest nuclear energy publicity efforts I've ever encountered, which was an effort by British Nuclear Fuels Limited, in which they hired the famous Flying Scotsman preserved steam locomotive to pull excursion trains to the Sellafield nuclear site for people to visit there. And BNFL, in addition to this, they commissioned a video about the publicity campaign. Well, it's a very strange video, because it's about 40 minutes, and it's almost entirely about the train trip. You won't learn anything about nuclear energy, basically, from watching this video. It's almost entirely about the train trip and getting the locomotive ready. And there's a truly harrowing scene of the engine driver and fireman cooking their lunch, where they put a whole pound, they take the coal shovel and they put a whole pound of butter on it, and then a bunch of sausages, and then they stick the coal shovel into the firebox of the locomotive. And I'm going to drop a link to that in comm here. sdf.org/l/2ph. That's sdf.org/lima/2papahotel. If you want to go, and that's where I put it up on TubeNix. Anyway, this is the second copy of this video that I've bought, maybe. And what I mean is that the first one I bought, I incautiously tried to have it mailed to me, and it disappeared into the yawning void of eBay's global shipping program and never came out again. And so sometime later, I found a copy of the videotape up for sale, and I purchased it, and I had arranged with Stug to have it sent to him. And British domestic shipping is reasonably reliable. He got it, and he even took point on getting it to someone to transfer it to a digital format so all you friends can watch it. And so I really do not know whether this videotape that I bought the second time might not have been the first one just come around again that had fallen into someone else's hands. What I will say is that sometime in the next few weeks, I plan on taking it to the National Railway Museum in York so that the folks in the National Railway Museum can catalog it, and they can do their own tape to digital transfer if they feel like it. Obviously, it's a PAL VHS tape, so the quality is somewhat limited, but it's very interesting anyway. But as I say, it's more of a rail fan interest item than it is a nuclear energy interest item, all things considered. Speaking of the National Railway Museum, there's also there's also a museum called Locomotion in Shildon near Darlington on the route of the original Stockton and Darlington Railway, which is sort of a branch of the National Railway Museum at York. Anyway, and I went there earlier this week, and they had some very interesting things on display, including the HST and APT prototypes, if you know what those are. Also, sort of the opposite of those things, a rail bus. Curiously, for a place called Locomotion and named after the Stevenson locomotive, which was known by that name, it has lots and lots of models and replicas of Timothy Hackworth's Saint-Pierre. Can't quite understand that. But yeah, so in addition to the HST and APT prototypes, it also has sort of the opposite of that, which is the rail bus prototype, which was literally a city bus, a British Leyland city bus, lifted and put on railway bogies. Well, now, I took a bunch of different kinds of traction to get from where I was staying at Sheerness on the Isle of Sheppey to Shildon near Darlington, but it didn't take me all that long. It was third rail electric as far as London Victoria. No, London, sorry. Third rail electric as far as London St. Pancras. My mistake. Then I walked across the street to London King's Cross. Now, I do not know whether there is a platform 9 3/4 at London King's Cross, but I will tell you that there is a platform 0 at London King's Cross, so clearly anything is possible. And then when I got to Darlington Station, I had got off the LNER Azuma direct train from London to Glasgow, and it's only 2.5 hours. I mean, it's like 2 hours from London to York, which is amazing, and then another, 20 minutes or so to Darlington. And then I had to change for the local service at from Darlington to Shildon, and that departed from platform 4A. Yeah. And that was a little diesel, I may have been diesel hydraulic rather than diesel electric, but a little diesel multiple unit job. Very noisy and stinky little thing called Spirit of the Royal Air Force, and all I can say about it is certainly was not an aircraft or anything resembling one. It was not flying. But it groaned and grumbled its way to Shildon, and they had on display a number of other things. I took a whole lot of photographs, most of which, the only SDFer who's likely to ever see them is Kuma, because of course I'm going to give Kuma all these photographs, because that's what I do with train photographs. But, yeah, and Kuma will tell you what she does with them. But they had a bunch of other stuff on display there, all very interesting. A couple of snow plows, although they're only the plow type snow plows, not the horrifying rotary snow plow they have on the California Railway Museum in Sacramento, which really looks like it is the vengeful ghost of a dead diesel locomotive here to devour your soul. That thing is terrifying. But if you know what a Bren gun carrier is, they had one of those on a drop center flat car. Anyway, but they had a thing on display which was very, very similar to the rail bus in concept, although very different in execution. And I'm going to describe it to you because I think it's worth talking about. They call it the Very Light Rail Vehicle or something like that. And it is a two-axle rail car, and it's battery electric, which seems like a strange choice, but I think I understand it. And it's built to be as lightweight as possible. And what is the purpose of this thing? Well, the answer is it's not intended to be a solution to any particular problem. Rather, it's a foot in the door. In other words, there is a... So there are a lot of disused rail lines in Britain, as there are in the United States. But a major difference between the United States and Britain in this regard is that many of the disused rail lines in Britain still have most of the rail in place and could potentially be reactivated. The thing being, of course, the maintenance, the permanent way is in extremely bad shape. And so to run trains over it, you need to do a lot of work, and that work costs money. And so their idea is to build the lightest possible passenger rail vehicle so that it can run on these disused lines with the minimum of maintenance of way effort put into it, and also where you have to lay down new rail, it can be the cheapest grade of rail. And that gets people used to there being service on this line, again, and it proves that there is demand for service on this line, which then... the idea is, has the planners and the people with the money break out the pocketbook to actually pay for upgrading the line to run real trains. And I think the reason they picked battery electric rather than diesel is simply that the diesel multiple unit, which is kind of the, you know, like the Stadler DMUs, the diesel vehicles, which are light rail vehicles, which are kind of the standard thing for this vague sort of application, such as the Dart Silver Line, which is a disused rail line in the Dallas area, which is going into commuter passenger service late this month with diesel rail vehicles, not with electrification the way that the rest of the Dart system is, for Christ's sake. The diesel vehicles are loud. That's all there is to it. They're loud. And so the battery electric at least has the value of being very quiet. Now, will this work? I don't know, but Britain desperately needs this kind of thing. Of course, anytime I talk about the Beeching Axe, the loss of a lot of the rail lines in Britain, I have to explain that I don't blame Dr. Beeching. Because there are two other things going on here. Firstly, when his report was presented in Parliament, somebody should have stood up and said, is this a picture of the Britain we want to live in? Do we really want to tear up the high street of every little village and turn it into a dual carriage motorway and effectively split the town in half because you can't cross a street like that? Peril of your life. So there's that, right? That it shouldn't have been presented as a done deal. It should have, somebody should have stood up to debate it. But the second thing that goes back to the beginning of the railroads, and it's the same problem that dogs the railroads in Britain in a lot of other ways. Nobody really understood railroading when they started putting in the railroads in Britain. And so, for example, the loading gauge is very small. The cars that they use on British railways are typically no bigger than Japanese mainline cars, which run on a 1,035 or something, 1,050 gauge. You know, they've got, the rails are gauged at 1,435 millimeters, but the rolling stock is very small because the bridges and the tunnels and so forth were designed based on somebody's guess in 1830 or 1840 of how big railway trains would be, and they didn't have any reasonable basis. The only person who built tunnels, 1067, says Coma, which I'm inclined to believe. The only person who built bridges and tunnels and so forth that were actually wide enough for real trains and tall enough was Isambard Kingdom Brunel. And horribly enough, many of his broad gauge lines, which are just single track, have been converted into dual track standard gauge lines. So, again, the loading gauge is restricted. Anyway, in the same way, many of the stations were built in places remarkably distant from the towns they were meant to serve, and there were several reasons for this. One of them being the prejudice of the landowners of the time, who simply didn't want the ash and fumes and noise of steam locomotives anywhere near them, which is understandable. There's also the prejudice I'm slightly less charitably inclined toward, which was that some of the landowners did not want the peasantry to be free to move about the countryside. So, when you had to harness up a horse to go to the station and take the train, it was one thing, but by the 1940s, 1950s, many rural people had some kind of motor car, and so instead of getting in the motor car and driving the mile and a half from the town to the station and then getting on the train, it made sense for them just to take the motor car all the way they were going. But the thing is, nobody asked, do we do as Dr. Beeching has outlined here, and then spend colossal sums of money on motorways, or do we spend 10% of that amount of money on moving the rail lines to serve the towns we actually have? Right? And that is always the salient question. Now, between Darlington and Shildon, I should say, there is another railway museum known as Hopetown, formerly the Head of Steam Museum and formerly the Darlington North Road Railway Museum, originally opened by Prince Philip in 1975, which was the 150th anniversary of the Stockton and Darlington Railway. Anyway, at the Head of Steam Museum, they've been running a cavalcade of live steam with some of the very famous steam locomotives, the Flying Scotsman, for example, and also the Tornado, which was a new-built steam locomotive, and they have another new-build steam locomotive under construction there. I didn't stop there. I might go another one of these days, because I'm going to be spending a great deal of time in Britain between now and about the 20th of November. So for any SDFers in Britain who would like to meet up with me, that would be, yeah, I'd be very open to that. A couple days ago, actually, I visited SDFer MC Hamley, who I must say has a lovely Maine Coon cat. And his wife made us a lovely dinner, but she apparently was not feeling up to company, so I didn't meet her. But I went to the railway station, and he met me at the station. We walked to his house. He introduced me to the cats. We talked. I got back to the station just in time to take the train I needed to get on, got back to London Victoria Station, and then another train broke down and meant that the train that I was supposed to get on to go back to a place called Sittingbourne, where the connecting train is for Sheerness, that train couldn't get to the station. So I had to take another service, and that got me to Sittingbourne much too late. The last train to Sheerness had already departed. I wound up spending $45 on cab fare to get back to Sheerness just to get to my hotel so that I could retrieve my bags and turn right around and go to London St. Pancras to get on the Eurostar to come back to Munich. It's, that wasn't great. Now that I think of it, I think I might have been able to get on the service for Gravesend, which was not impacted, it was not affected by this problem, and then from on that train change at Rochester to one of the southeastern high-speed javelins, they call them, to go as far as Sittingbourne, and that might have brought me there in time, but neither I nor the personable young man who was making the announcements on the platform and trying to explain to people what they should do next, neither of us thought of that. So, anyway, by the time I got back to Munich, I was rather done in, and I'm sure that's part of what I am, that's part of why I'm not in the best of shape. Now, but while I was on the train to Darlington, right, north from London King's Cross Station, we happened to pass by Drax the Destroyer. You could just see it out the window. On the right-hand side, if you're facing forward, that is to say north, you look out the window, and it's very distinctive. There's, of course, the four big cooling towers, and the giant chimney, which is one of the tallest structures in Great Britain. It is really distinctive. There is no way of mistaking it for anything else. Nevertheless, my seatmate, who was a German, thought it was Atomkraftwerk, a nuclear power plant, because it had cooling towers. So I spent some time explaining to him, in a mixture of English and broken German, or broken English his and broken German mine, that no, there are no nuclear power plants in Britain with cooling towers. They're all cooled with seawater. Now, there used to be nuclear power plants in Britain with cooling towers. Calder Hall and Chapel Cross, despite being on the sea, had cooling towers. Don't ask me to explain it to you. I don't understand that decision. And Trosfynydd in Wales did not have a cooling tower, but it was located on a lake rather than the seaside. And the Winfrith steam-generating heavy water reactor prototype, if I recall correctly, had a bank of those low force draft cooling, not a big hyperboloidal cooling tower, but a big bank of those low force draft cooling towers, which must have been only for additional cooling. But yes, Drax, as I call it, Drax the Destroyer, the giant, which is a comic book reference, the giant coal-fired power plant that the Central Electricity Generating Board did not want, but the government of the time required them to build it because they wanted to support employment in the coal sector, Coal mining jobs are awful. Don't support employment in the coal sector? Jesus Christ. Anyway, if the Central Electricity Generating Board had their way, they would have built some more nuclear power plants, not anywhere near the Drax site. I will remark, one of my slides for my Introduction to Atomic Energy talk has a photograph of a power plant with a whole bunch of cooling towers. And I say, does anybody know what nuclear power plant this is? And then, no, that's a trick question. This is actually a coal-fired power plant in Poland. But yes, Britain has coal-fired power plants, or, well, they used to be coal-fired power plants with cooling towers. But Drax has been switched over to burning wood. Wood shipped from North America. I am very much against this. I am deeply opposed to this, as I have said many times before. And that's why I call it Drax the Destroyer. I do not believe that there is any decent excuse for cutting down, in some cases, primary forest in North America, turning it into little pellets, loading those pellets on an oil-burning ship, shipping them halfway around the world to burn them in a plant to make electricity. We have much better ways of making electricity. We also have much better ways of making heat. You know, because the thing is, a thermal power plant of any kind uses heat to make electricity. And burning wood to make heat, I mean, on a very small scale, right, if you're out in the wilderness, it's a grand idea. But once you get above the scale where you're picking up dead branches off the ground, you run into two problems. Firstly, there ain't enough trees in the world, brother. Just ain't enough trees in the world. Remember that Europe was deforested by the year 1700, right? This is the reason why the French, as I keep saying, this is the reason why the French and the English fought so hard over North America, because they wanted the, come on, friends, say it with me, this is the forest primeval, the towering pines and the hemlocks. They wanted those tall, straight trees, which there were no more of in Germany, in Europe. We're no more of in Europe, basically no more in Britain or Ireland or on the continent, or hardly even in Scandinavia. They wanted them to make ships, and particularly the masts of ships, because the cutting of wood for charcoal burning had led to a great absence of that. Well, the population of Europe in the year 1600 or 1700 was far smaller than it is today. Everything is, you know, then the energy demand of the average European was also far smaller than it is today. We can't rely on wood burning. Europe alone would deforest the entire world in a year or two. Tin from Berlin mentions he spent a few days at a place in Romania that used wood burning for everything, including hot water. Of course, you can also, near Cernavoda in Romania, spend a few days at a place which uses nuclear energy for everything, including hot water. Because Cernavoda is one of those progressive-thinking, forward-thinking nuclear power plants that supplies heat to its local area. I'll also remark that the British AGR, Advanced Gas-Cooled Reactor, nuclear power plants were designed to be safe enough for urban siting, and there was a proposal, at least half serious, to replace the Battersea Power Station with an AGR, because Battersea was one of the few places in Britain that had a district heating scheme, a combined heat and power scheme, but instead they turned it into an art museum. And forgive me, MC Hamley, for making this joke again, but only you've heard it so far. Although it's often said that art critics generate more heat than light, I've never heard of the hot air they produce being used to heat people's homes. Anyway, thanks for listening to A Step Farther Out on Anon Radio, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. This show airs every Saturday at 19 UTC, just before the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, with daily show at 19:30. My other shows, Hear Now the Words, air at Tuesdays and...